seventh annual collaboration with the Southeast European Studies at Oxford, by the way, CSOCS, and I'm delighted to welcome them back to yourself. We held our first joint event 6 years ago, back in 2013. Our partnership has gone from strength to strength, and I think it's a very fruitful one. I hope we can continue it. CSOCS has been in existence since 2002. Its traditional focus has been on the geopolitics of the region. This remains really its core interest. More recently, CSOCS has also been studying diasporas, beginning with a highly significant Greek diaspora in this country, in the USA, in Australia, and indeed in many other places as well. Earlier this year, in the Hillary Town at Oxford, CSOCS broadened the focus to a more general and a comparative way at the diasporas of all the countries of Southeast Asia. This Hillary Town seminar series is the bedrock of today's presentation on the impact of diasporas on hosts and members. There is, of course, a dark side to diasporas, indeed, including the possible involvement of organized crime corruption. So, we have a fairly large area to cover this morning. I hope we can get down if we can do it with a reasonable expedition. We're very fortunate today to have Dr. Manolis Patsinakis, who's on my left. Dr. Fratini Palazzi and Dr. Pathanai Starkis, who's been here on many occasions before, and they will be talking on the general theme of constructive engagement, while Sir David Madden, who's there on the right, reports on the dark side. They will speak in that order, and you should all have seen their bulletins in advance. I'm not going to go through them in detail now, so I think we need to make use of the time we've got. Instead, I'm going to hand over to my notice to start us off on the substance of today's seminar, the diasporas of Southeast Europe and their role in international relations.
Lord Lothian, Jacqueline, I would like to thank you very much for the organization of this event and for the kind invitation. My presentation is going to be fairly broad. My aim is more or less to set the scene and contextualize the diasporas in the southeast of Europe as an outcome of recent massive and ongoing emigration flows from this region. I will also attempt to highlight the significance that the diasporas have for their respective countries in this particular moment, drawing from examples from our from presentations that we had in our seminar series in the previous term. And I will focus a little bit more on intra-EU mobility and the phenomenon of brain drain. So the first point I would like to highlight is that with the transition to democracy and open market economy, the countries in southeast of Europe emerged as a major exporter of migration. In the early years, Greece has been an outlier in this trend. But as you know, with the post-2008 financial crisis that hit particularly strongly Greece, there has been a resurgence of emigration from Greece, which has been traditionally an emigration country too. And as a result, we can say that currently the whole region shares a common fate, so to say, as an area of emigration. Just to give you some information about the numbers, starting from the Western Balkans in particular, Albania and Bosnia both have diaspora populations which are equivalent to half of the population living in the respective countries. And this is this concerns diasporas that have emerged pretty much out of migrations that have taken place over the past 20-25 years. We're speaking of 1.5 million Albanians and approximately 2 billion Bosnians. The current size of the Serbian diaspora is around 1 million, which is equivalent to 15% of the population in the country. Since the 1990s, Bulgaria's population has depleted by approximately 2 million citizens, which is approximately 25% of the population of the country. And in terms of absolute numbers, the country that has the largest diaspora that has formed out of this recent migration is Romania, which is in fact a country among the 20 which have the largest emigration populations worldwide. So not only in the region, not only in Europe, but worldwide. So it's 3.6 million people who left the country over the past years. Even Greece, which, as I mentioned, was up until recently an immigration country, receiving, in fact, to a large extent, also migration from the other Southeast European countries, has emerged also as an immigration country. Approximately 800,000 people left Greece. Half of this population are migrants in Greece, some of them of other Balkan countries, and the other half concerns Greek citizens, approximately 400,000 Greeks that left during and because of the financial crisis Greece. So this extensive migration over the past years is reflected in the demographic profiles and the demographic projections of the countries in the region. Obviously, those graphs not only showcase the outcome of migration, but also declining birth rates, which are very low in several countries in the Balkan. But overall, the demographic trajectories need to be taken into account when discussing emigration from this region and the diasporas from those countries. And as we can see, in all countries are currently already declining, and decline is to further be expected if we look at the trajectory for the next 30 years, and even with the most positive possible scenario, which is the red line that you see here. And at the bottom right corner, I have the UK, just for the sake of comparison, and to showcase, UK is pretty much characteristic of the trends in Northern and Western Europe, which is unlike the, those in the area we're discussing today, the Balkans. So the point I want to make that this is not a general European trend, but it is rather characteristic to the southeast of Europe. Obviously, there have been differences on the way those like migration flows have taken place and the diasporas have formed as a result of them. And broadly, we can speak of three different types of flows. We had refugee flows and migration that has happened as a result of wars in the successor states of former Yugoslavia. Refugees from Bosnia, from Kosovo and so forth. And we had economic migration, which was particularly acute for the case of Albania. Many academics define the people who left Albania during the beginning of the 1990s and also during the 97 after the collapse of the pyramid scheme, which triggered a huge crisis in the in Albania, as economic refugees. And of course, we have labor migration from Bulgaria that was ongoing and from Romania. And currently, we have migration that takes place in the context of free movement within the European Union. The joining in of Romania, Bulgaria, and more recently of Croatia has, in fact, led to the raise of numbers of the migrants from those countries. So here you can see that the Balkan states that are members of the European Union are among those who contribute the most to free movement within the European Union. But it's not only this, but their integration in the European Union meant also a change of destinations and also slightly a change in the socioeconomic and demographic characteristics of the people who left the countries. And possibly the issue that is most commonly discussed and for which there are more concerns expressed is the educational background of the people. And I will here use the Greek case, which is maybe the most characteristic. And as we see here, is this shows the share, the third, the more dark blue column shows the share of tertiary educated people through time per decade. And as you see, we have a continuous increase. And of course, this partly at least reflects the rise of people with university degrees increase through time. But still, if we can focus here on the second, on the central graph, which shows that in Greece, the people of 25 to 35 years old age, 40% of them have university degrees, whereas among the migrants, this is close to 70. So it's much more probable for the people with higher educational attainments to leave their countries. And as a result, this has triggered concerns about the phenomenon of brain drain. And the freedom of movement within the European Union, we know that it has been praised by the citizens of the European Union as one of the most important achievements of the Union. At least that's what we get from EU-wide polls. But it's also true that over the past years there has been a questioning of it, starting from the eastwards expansion and the concomitant increase of emigration flows, the Eurozone crisis, and the so-called refugee crisis and the decision of people in the UK to leave the European Union. So most of this questioning is discussed in relation to the situation in receiving countries. Despite the fact that from what we know from the empirical material that we have, showcases that EU mobile citizens are net contributors to welfare in the countries where they head to, and in addition they're overall more highly educated than the local populations where they settle. But except from the questioning of the freedom of movement in receiving countries, at least in this region we have a problematization of it in relation to the increase of migration and the phenomenon of brain drain. So the increased mobility options that are afforded to people who are members of the European Union seems to increase migration, and especially the migration of highly skilled people. But at the same time, it does, at least theoretically, ease the adjustment of the migrants and possibly facilitates the socioeconomic progress, and also could potentially help them sustain transnational ties with their respective homelands. So, and that relates to a wider debate, policy debate, but also a debate in academia, where you have two positions. And on the one hand, you have those who argue that international migration of professionals massively erodes the human capital and fiscal revenues of sending countries and drives them into a spiral of underdevelopment. Whereas, on the other hand, you have more positive views which claim that the migration of professionals could, under certain conditions, act as a force for development, for sending countries through remittances, but also facilitation of trade, investments, and also critically important knowledge transfers. And so they conceive the presence of a highly educated labor force abroad as a kind of a mobilized asset the southeast of Europe. And indeed, the support that those populations offer in their countries is very real, and we don't have to limit ourselves to the highly educated. Speaking of all migrants and the significant role that they have for the survival of many households in poorer countries, in Western Balkan region, for instance, and generally in the alleviation of poverty through flows of remittances, but as I said, also the transmission of values. And we had a seminar, presentation in a seminar series by Yuli Vullnetari, who focused on the Albanian case in particular, the significance of remittances in that respect, but also the values that go with them, and she particularly highlighted how it has helped the further emancipation of women from rural Albania, both abroad and in the country of origin. But obviously, the magnitudes of the potential positive effects of diaspora involvement and return migration, which is also something that is needed, that can bring to a source economy, depends on the scale of the impact, its evolution through time, and critically the involvement of national and local governments in coordination with diaspora and migrant organizations in order to maximize those benefits. And there are several challenges involved. And I would like to conclude again by referring to a presentation in our seminar series by Elena Genova, who focused on the Bulgarian case and the identity processes of Bulgarians living in... living in the UK. And she highlighted that those challenges do not come only from the receiving society, but also from the country of origin, from Bulgaria, whereby they are seen as, deserters or even traitors. And she highlighted the processes through which people of Bulgarian origin tried to rebuild their identity by referring to the so-called second Bulgarian revival and presenting themselves as potential enlighteners, a new cohort of enlighteners, and also, so to say, ambassadors of their country abroad, trying to be the best Bulgarians they can so that they represent to the best of their ability their country. So we see in that respect that, you know, there are challenges also in that respect that have to be overcome so that there is a facilitation of transfers of all kinds. And with this I would like to conclude and pass it to Fortuny, who will speak more about the political dimension.
Good morning. Thank you, Lord Lothian, for the invitation, and Jacqueline for arranging all the organizational matters. I'm going to speak about diaspora's political engagement in a comparative perspective, a theme explored in our seminar series. Our focus mainly on countries of Southeast Europe offers a diversity of cases, such as Greece, Cyprus, Bosnia, Serbia, and Turkey, which on the one hand they exemplify the similarity of current issues shared by some of these countries, like brain drain, and on the other hand they elucidate how the different economic, political and social homeland conditions set a crucial background for the political engagement of diasporic communities. For example, the wars of the 1990s led to the breakup of the former Yugoslavia and the creation of a number of newly independent states, while waves of emigration began earlier, starting from the 1960s, in response to limited employment, the wars accelerated the movement of people out of these countries. But first of all, I would like to focus on the case of Greece, one of diaspora and economic crisis. The case of Greece is one of an advanced Western economy and consolidated democracy undergoing a protracted recession with severe social consequences and major political changes. The effects of extreme austerity, mistrust towards the institutions and disappointment from the political system shaped a completely different mobility picture for Greeks. In these extraordinary circumstances, the role of diaspora increased, not only numerically, but as an agent with the potential to bring change and affect domestic political affairs. Within this context, one of the most prominent issues that has been dominating the public and political discourse in Greece is the political participation of Greeks abroad, and more specifically, the right to vote. This issue reappeared in the forefront of political debate and has been vigorously discussed in the Greek Parliament. According to the research that we have conducted in the Greek Parliament Hansards, there aren't many major ideological divisions between parties on diasporic issues. All of them appeal to diasporic sensitivities. But parties on the right-wing spectrum supported the right of vote compared to the left-wing party Syriza, which acknowledged some technical difficulties. This has to do with the fact that Mitsotakis, the leader of the conservative New Democracy, saw a big connection with the third wave, the brain drainers, and a traditional affinity with the older, more socially conservative waves. Despite the fact, though, that all the Greek parties in principle agreed towards giving the Greeks abroad the right to vote, without them, of course, being obliged to go back to their homeland to exercise their rights, this has never been instrumentalized, with the exception of the latest European elections. The latest results from the European elections show that New Democracy surpassed Syriza by 18.61% among diaspora Greeks who voted in the EU countries, and this confirmed the inkling that the Greeks abroad, and especially those who left because of the economic crisis, mostly identify themselves with the economic agenda of New Democracy. Now I would like to move to a different, completely different issue, that of diaspora and ethnic conflicts, focusing on two cases, that of Bosnia and that of Cyprus. The cases of Bosnia and Cyprus illustrate the diversified political engagement of diasporic groups. Their activities reflect, in some cases, a long-distance nationalism or a will to move away from ethno-nationalist political debates. In the case of Bosnia-Herzegovina, the interest on the role of the diaspora is connected with its recent war past. An important characteristic of the Bosnian diaspora is its division along ethnic lines. We have the Bosnian Croats, the Bosnian Serbs, the Bosnian Muslims, the so-called Bosniaks, and some argue that this heterogeneity undermines internal solidarity among the diaspora and reinforces ethnic divisions. Also, there is a certain perception that any diaspora involvement in Bosnian politics might pose a threat to the political equilibrium. However, as a contrasting view, research has shown that under certain conditions, Bosnians who left in comparison to those who stayed in the country may promote inclusive and reconciliatory attitudes. According to a research project comparing two different Bosnian communities in Sweden and the USA, diaspora's political ambitions do not necessarily mirror those of their homeland or of their host states, and consequently their mobilization reflects the same. The researcher exemplified and consequently exemplified that diaspora cultural production on the Srebrenica genocide remembrance can be more moderate and aims to move away from ethno-nationalist public political debates evidenced in Bosnia's post-conflict political environment. And now moving on to the case of Cyprus. The long-standing conflicts between the Greek and Turkish side is an issue that is reflected in the political engagement of both communities. Research has provided both views. On the one hand, Cypriots, Greeks and Turks are just as likely to provide nationalistic and chauvinist arguments which serve the perceived political interests of their respective political representations within the nation states as those who still live in Cyprus. It has been argued that in the case of the Greek Cypriots, the desire is to use the diaspora in order to promote a solution to the Cyprus problem, and at times has included the desire to re-establish a majoritarian Cypriot state. In the case of the Turkish Cypriots, the diaspora is sought to promote the retention of effective separation, albeit within a weak federal state. On the other hand, there are multiple examples of diaspora activists for peace, and diaspora returnees who support bicommunalism. The 2004 Annan Plan referendum was a wake-up call for the diasporas and demonstrated their strong desire to be involved in Cypriot politics, including, naturally, a discussion of property compensation. In addition, skepticism has been exemplified through research as to what extent that Turkish Cypriots can assist towards peace-building processes. For example, Turkish Cypriot transnational lobbying in Britain highlights how lack of access to host country political establishment limits migrants' influence on processes of democratization in their country of origin. And now moving on to the case of Serbia. And according to the International Organization of Migration, 9.8% of all citizens of Serbia live outside the country of origin. Members of the Serbian diaspora, especially those vocal in representing their country's views, have previously been regarded as leaning towards nationalistic stances. However, recent emigrants tend to be more educated than their predecessors, and when looking into the political stances, and according to a study that Tena Prelec has conducted about the 2017 Serbian presidential election, a majority of the politically active members of the diaspora do not show great interest in topics that are usually linked to nationalistic stances, while expressing the highest concerns over governance issues. Now a couple of things on the Turkish case, and with this I will conclude. On this case, we have discussed how internal politics and divisions can be reproduced with the Turkish communities abroad. The different waves of Turkish migration to the West do not only just reflect a desire for economic opportunities, but often reflect political and ethnic divergences at home. Past waves have included economic migrants to Germany and the USA, but they also included left-wing emigres fleeing past dictatorship, Kurds, the diasporas connected with connected to the Gulenist movement, as well as supporters of Kemalist and lately Erdogan's government. The importance that Erdogan has attached to the diasporic vote in Europe and the Balkans has been evident in the mobilization of voters abroad in the recent elections, which were seen as vital for the continuation of his presidential and personal rule. But the divisions that this caused to the diasporas abroad have also been notable. So, as illustrated with all this diversity of cases in Southeast Europe, diaspora can be a progressive force that seeks peace, reunification, reform, or resistance to authoritarianism. It can be a status quo force seeking regime stability, and also a backward force promoting ethnic divisions and nationalistic attitudes. Thank you. And I believe it's Dr. Othon Anastasakis who will speak about Brexit and diaspora.
Jacqueline and Lord Lothian, thank you so much for bringing us here again. It's always a pleasure for us at CSOX to come and discuss with you the fruits of our annual labors. So it's an incredible pleasure today that I'm also presenting, along with my colleagues, our own research on diaspora, but also what we've been discussing with guest speakers in Oxford. And I would like to bring the issue of diaspora in the UK context, if I may, because it's also relevant to all of us here. I only have one slide that I will put there as a background. and this is about numbers, just to have a sense of perspective as to how many Southeast Europeans are living in this country. There we are. I'll leave this in the background. So Britain has been a destination, a very popular destination, for a big number of migrants from Southeast Europe. We've got Cypriots, Greeks and Turks historically moving to the UK. We know about the bonds between Cyprus and Britain and the Commonwealth links as well. We've got Greeks as well as a historical diaspora in the shipping, banking or academia, and a very large community of students as well from Greece. We had Yugoslav dissidents moving to this country from the communist years, but also post-Yugoslavs because of the wars, and lately Bulgarians and Romanians. So the issue of migration, as we all know, in this country and connected to Southeast Europe has been particularly important and sensitive, and especially in the post-2000 British approach towards Southeast Europe. We all remember the Blair open door policy and EU enlargement, supportive of a big single market in the EU, a strong EU economic space, Britain as advocates of enlargement, emphasis on single market, flexible British market, English language, the welfare system. All this was a very attractive collection of issues that made migrants from Eastern Europe migrate here. So the UK was one of only three EU member states, alongside Sweden and Ireland, to open its labour market to the new EU citizens immediately. At the same time, of course, it has to be said that Labour's decision was also largely uncontroversial in the Parliament and was supported by all political parties here. So Bulgarians and Romanians in particular have been the centre of a lot of controversy in migration from Southeast Europe. They both arrived after the turn of the millennium, connected with three important policy developments in this country. The first wave was a 2001 UK migration policy, which was allowing them a liberalized access to working visas under employment programs and business projects. Another policy in 2002, which established a selective opening of the UK market and created separate conditions for citizens of Bulgaria and Romania. Then after their accession in 2007, the UK lifted visa regime restrictions and regulated access to the UK's borders, yet retained some restrictions on labour rights of Bulgarians and Romanians until 2013, when everything was opened. So that is the legacy of Blair. In a sense, wasn't expecting the unintended consequences of many Bulgarians and Romanians coming to this country. Overall, we know a lot about migration, the reasons why people decide to leave their countries. We've been discussing some with Manolis. We don't know a lot about the migrants' identities, their degree of integration in the countries where they live, their contributions to host countries, their behavior as diasporas, their networks, and their ties with homelands. And we've got limited information on that, and this is also one of the reasons why all this migration discussion is often amenable to generalizations and stereotypes, and I will be talking about that in a little bit. So we've got the historical diasporas, the Cypriots and the Greeks, and there is their own kind of social status in a way, especially from the Greek diaspora, is more of a middle and upper class status that has been traditionally linked with banking and merchant capital and academia and medicine. And also a very big number of students, as I mentioned. Even at present, Greece finances 11,000 students in British universities. Consider also the economic crisis that has impacted, you know, a lot the advent of students here in this country. At the same time, Greeks and Greek Cypriots, they've also established their Greek churches, their schools, 200 they are around that. Also, we can say that compared to other nations, the established infrastructure and the networks, they enable Greek nationals to come to the UK and integrate, but while also allowing for their own Greek culture to develop too. It's a very liberal environment, and that is also common with the other, for the other countries of Southeast Europe. So that is taken for granted, you know, the liberal environment, how attractive the country is. Now let me go to the negatives, because I don't want to be just on the positive side, but I have to comment also the recent debates about it. Bulgarians and Romanians started migrating in significant numbers after the Cold War, after the end of the Cold War in 1989. The most popular destination initially was US, Canada, Spain, Germany, and other countries of Western Europe, including Greece. The UK was favored mostly after the new millennium for the reasons that I also highlighted before. For both the 2007 EU accession migration was followed by another migration wave, particularly in the mid-2010s, coinciding with the global financial crisis. Some Bulgarians and Romanians previously employed in other countries, especially in the south of Europe, in Greece, Malta, Spain, Italy, and France, they moved to the UK as part of their own circular migration. So the numbers were particularly increased during that time, during those years. And I've got a figure here, it was by nearly 80% from 230,000 in 2014, they went up to 413,000 in 2017. So at present, we can see also from here that Romanians, and Manolis did point out how big diaspora is around the world. Here in the UK, it's actually the second biggest diaspora after the Poles, the Romanians. As for the social composition, I'm borrowing some figures from Maria Koinova, who's doing a lot of work on diaspora, but also on Bulgarian diaspora. And a 2018 survey on Bulgarians here in London shows that Bulgarians are far from unemployed. Actually, all of them are employed. Half of them are doing a second job as well. They can be high-skilled jobs, like IT specialists, analysts, programmers, engineers, university lecturers, marketing and public relations. And there are also low-skilled jobs, typically with cleaning and housekeeping services or care provision for elderly and others, car mechanics, etc. Over 60% of Bulgarians in the UK work in the services sectors, like hotel, restaurants, and etc. So let's go now to the other dimension, which is about the otherization and the stereotypes, because the issue of stereotypes has been raised also in our seminar series, and in our work at CISOX in general, but at the same time we've been following this discussion during the last years. One of the things that one of our speakers mentioned is that British perceptions of the different groups results in the adoptions of various different ethnic identity choices by those diaspora groups. And she was comparing, interesting comparison, the Southern Europeans to the Eastern Europeans, and how Southern Europeans are viewed in this country as more cosmopolitan, even exotic as well, you know, thinking of Italy and the Roman past, and then Greece and the ancient past and all that, and it's also the tourism that benefits this approach, versus the stigmatization towards East Europeans. And the Romanians there are very, very prominent in how they're being stigmatized. And that's what leads, you know, what Manolis mentioned earlier, for Romanians and Bulgarians in particular, to want to show their best self while living in this country. That they are the true ambassadors in this country, that they have adopted the Western values, but also that they're benefiting their homeland as well in many respects. And it's interesting, and Manolis also mentioned that, that they're being otherized, not just in this country and other Western societies, but also in their own homeland as well, as being, you know, strangers who have left an abandoned homeland. Now, the crisis also affected approaches and attitudes in this country, on top of what has already been mentioned. And also we are seeing that various Southern Europeans as well, you know, attitudes did change. We see statements, first political statements, like in 2012, Theresa May, Home Secretary then, she stated that the UK would stop migrants if Euro collapses, with plans for immigration controls put in place. And then David Cameron even added to this, I will do whatever it takes to protect the United Kingdom from Greek influx. So there's a kind of a similar negative, scary publicity which develops. And it did develop, if we remember, with Turkey as well, which was an argument that Boris Johnson, in particular, with his Ottoman origins, he also mentioned the fear of Turks coming into this country. Later, he forgot about it because he denied that he ever said it, but we all remember it very well, and it's part of this kind of picture. Now, the role of popular media, in particular, in the negative attitudes towards Bulgarians and Romanians has been visible. One thing that quickly became apparent was that media coverage contained a selective mixture of statistics, reported comments from politicians and other public figures, academic studies or think tank reports, very selectively, and emotive polemics as well, emotive polemics, backed with no evidence at all. And that was the kind of the media representation in the UK of Romanians and Bulgarians, often connecting them to high crime rates or welfare benefits. Now, my last point is the impact of Brexit on Southeast European people living in this country. Now, Brexit, in a general sense, is placing bilateralism in the UK relations with individual European states and raising large political and geopolitical questions that are affecting citizens from this country of the region living in the UK. So in the large picture, the UK, as a traditional advocate of enlargement, will cease to exist, although it is hard to think at the moment, given the overall reluctance towards enlargement from both France and Germany, whether the UK attitude would have made any difference. There are other issues as well that are affecting the different diasporas in the UK. So the historical diasporas are revising their homeland roots, in a way, through acquiring passports, and in some cases, citizenships, as the Greek and the Cypriot consulates know very well and how busy they are these days with this. Those who have not acquired UK citizenship, they have to settle for the settled status or the pre-settled status at the moment. But are there also Bulgarians and Romanians that are struggling with uncertainty in real terms? It's an interesting finding. According to the Bulgarian Centre for Social Integration in London, among the low-skilled Bulgarians, there are several problems for Bulgarian citizens in the UK. The lack of language skills, lack of sufficient digital skills, inability to present the required documents, as well as lack of information about the procedures. So these are those who could not meet the criteria for settled or pre-settled status or citizenship, who are mainly seasonal or low-paid workers, people with low education, or those working without a contract. Bulgarian citizens who cannot prove their stay because they are not registered, as well as pensioners who leave their children in the UK but are not registered and could not prove having lived there for the last 5 years. More questions have to do with the future of universities, tuition fees for students, the conditions for future migration, the fear of more exclusionary discourses on the migrant perception, economic uncertainty for those who have businesses in the UK, and for non-EU citizens from the Western Balkans and Turkey, the diminishing prospects for a trouble-free movement and further restrictions for entry and what this means for their travel in the UK. For those contemplating leaving because of Brexit, others consider moving to their country, others to Germany, others back to the places of Southern Europe where they came from previously, and some also considering Canada or the United States. So it's part of this circular migration. All in all, the nexus Southeast European diasporas in the UK raises various issues. It is a source for Euroscepticism, and oftentimes Southeast European migrants are instrumentalized for the enhancement of further anti-Europeanism. Having said that, diasporas from Southeast Europe who thought that their countries were par excellence problematic and messy politically, they discover that problematic and messy politics are not just their own prerogative, but it can happen in the oldest of parliamentary democracies too. But most importantly, Southeast Europe European countries and their citizens are themselves affected by their own emigration. Their homeland economies, political systems, demographics and societies are suffering because of the exodus of their most energetic and active parts of their societies. With all the diasporic populations from the Balkans, Greece, Turkey, Cyprus, the question is under what conditions would some of them and to what degree they would consider leaving the UK as a permanent home or going back. Each people have their own national answers to give. In Greece, they are waiting for the economy to pick up, for job opportunities to be on offer, for reforms to take place. For people from the Balkans, they express similar arguments and concerns to those of Greece, but they also include more politically oriented comments, including complaints about political corruption and incompetence in their homeland. For other people of the region, illiberalism is a very big obstacle to their advancement and well-being and return to the country. So until conditions arrive, diaspora populations from Southeast Europe will continue to act their various identity roles, stereotyped or not, be torn between host country and homeland, while it remains to be seen how Brexit, if it happens, is going to affect their decision to stay or leave for whatever destination that is. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to reflect my colleagues in saying warm thanks to Lord Lothian and, of course, to Jacqueline as well for once again making CSOX welcome at one of your meetings. As Lord Lothian mentioned in his introduction, this is the seventh such occasion and we feel very privileged. And it's also a great pleasure to see in the room so many friends of CSOX, including ambassadors and a certain High Commissioner, very distinguished High Commissioner, who we were hosting to lunch in Oxford the last week. Ah, was that all inaudible? Anyway, I said thank you to Lord Lothian and Jacqueline. In his introduction, Lord Lothian drew attention to the differences between the main seminar series, which was a comparative study of the diasporas of Southeast Europe, and the one-off seminar examining the dark side of these diasporas. This difference extends also to this presentation. Othon, Manoli and Fotini are all diasporic experts speaking on their own subjects and in their own right. I am simply a rapporteur reporting on a seminar which was addressed by three experts. These were Dr. Liz David Barrett, Director of the Centre for the Study of Corruption at Sussex University, who mapped out the mechanisms connecting organised crime and corruption and analysed the opportunities and challenges faced by the diasporas. Edrin Gjoni, who is the Community Engagement Officer in the Home Office for the Albanian community, he talked about the cultural mindset of certain sectors of the diaspora which facilitated organised crime groups, or OCG in the jargon. And then John Howell of the eponymous JH and Company, who examined the criminal justice statistics on UK crime involving Western Balkan nationals and the background to these. My purpose today is to briefly synthesise these contributions and also draw some tentative conclusions about the role of diasporas. Having diagnosed corruption and clientelist policies in the region, Dr. David Barrett asked where the diasporas came in. She advanced three hypotheses. OCG relationships relied heavily on trust, and transnational diaspora networks helped create such trust, facilitated by shared ethnicity, culture, and language, and by familiar reinforcement mechanisms such as threats to family back home. Secondly, OCG relied on access to markets and resources, and diasporas, who were often migrants who had travelled abroad to seek economic opportunities, could supply local knowledge of and facilitate access to particular markets, and they were in turn vulnerable to extortion. Third, loyalty under small town mechanism or mentality meant a reduced readiness to inform on corrupt on compatriots as a result both of fear of retribution and a sense of shame. Edrin Gjoni reported that there were 802 Albanian offenders in UK prisons. Comparative figures for other West Balkan countries are Kosovo, 42, Bosnia-Herzegovina, 9, Serbia, 5, North Macedonia, 3, and a single solitary Montenegrin. This followed an enormous increase in the Albanian community in the UK from 1990 to the present as a result of disruption and economic hardship in the region. He described the cultural mindset of certain segments of the diaspora which disposed them towards OCG. These included a history of alienation from the state, which was seen both as an oppressive force and also as a cow to be milked, because the state itself was traditionally seen as a thief. Lack of collective conscience and social movements, the loss of traditional values under communist rule, a culture dominated by the idea of strong men and the clans around them, a tribal and regional identity, and, in the absence of some countervailing wholesome values, the worship of wealth, the rule of the SUV. Given the statistics, John Howell also looked mainly at the Albania case, but acknowledged that the problems were certainly not unique to the Albanians. He looked at the various push-pull factors. The organised crime groups enjoyed good commercial instincts, logistical know-how, and a reputation for efficiency. They also profited from a favourable background: war economies, the capture of public and private institutions, cross-passporting, porous borders, and weak rule of law. On the diaspora side, people might feel that they had little to lose. Other sustaining arguments were, it's not a crime, but acceptable enrichment, and the organised crime groups met a demand. There was a vicious circle of unemployment, poverty and corruption. What was needed in Albania was for politicians and enablers to up their game. Outside the region, there should be a medium to long-term strategy, working with partners and working also with Albanian and other Southeast European enforcement agencies. In the Q&A session following the three presentations, the following points were made. There was a lack of options for migrants from the Western Balkans to enter and work legally in the rest of Europe. The vulnerabilities of migrants and the diasporas were ruthlessly exploited by organised crime groups. Regional stability and education were essential elements of an enduring solution to the problems. And, as an overall conclusion to the session, criminality seemed to follow the diasporas and use them as bases, supply lines and contacts, rather than actively being encouraged by them. Money followed the diasporas rather than the other way around. Thank you very much.
About 50 minutes, just
remiss if I were not at the outset to thank, of course, Global Strategy Forum and CSOCs for these events, and especially on an issue like the diaspora and their role in international relations, which does not really deserve. So this is almost a new ground in many ways, in order to be addressed in a scientific and academic way. I'm a practitioner, so I'm crypto academic, but I'm a practitioner, and whatever writing he has, references were made to the Cypriot diaspora, the Cypriot Greek background, the Turkish background. Let's not forget the Armenians, Balkans, and Atlantis, because they are all part of the quint. But at least from my own perspective in the last 6 years, and I'm coming towards the end of my tenure here, and also coming towards the end of my 43-year service, missionary service to my country, and I feel a little like Brexit, actually. Conventional deal. But anyhow, it is a really multi-layered, multi-faceted issue of the diaspora, because they are not monolithic. At least I'm talking about the Cypriots here in the United Kingdom, even like Cypriots in the United States and in some other countries that I serve. They're not monolithic. They have a mind of their own. I realized that even more so during the Brexit referendum and the debate, because even though we had an opinion about Brexit, didn't have a say, but at the same time, I gently tried to say, because I also published in the LSE and how this would affect Cyprus, because that's affect how this would affect Europe. And overall, they did. My assessment is that they voted pretty much along the national lines. And maybe a little more for Remain, 60-40 or something. So the issue that I want to say is that they have a mind of their own. They're no longer transients. They're here. They contribute to the United Kingdom. They do have, the older generation, of course, there's still their connections in Cyprus. At the same time, the younger generation, they are on their own. You have the organized homogenia, the organized diaspora, but you have a lot of them that are not. A lot of them that are in the city, and they are the second, the third, fourth generations. On the issue that was made on the national question, and I think that's where it also comes in, the role of international relations. Don't forget that a lot of the issues in Cyprus itself export themselves to the community here, because there are branches of different parties. Those that are conservatives are conservatives. Those that are labor are labor. Those that are Lib Dems are Lib Dems. And even Cypriot, let's say, of a UK Cypriot, of conservative, goes for a election, it doesn't necessarily mean that the labor UK Cypriot would vote for him or for her. So, I mean, it's interesting. On the national issue, okay, I think there is a common denominator. But again, the other factor that needs to be taken into consideration is, of course, the external factors. I mean, it's not just dimensional. It's not just the Cypriots here and in other areas in the diaspora in the world that, just by themselves. I think by ourselves, we will find our own path and our own solution. Ceasefire line opened up since 2003. I don't know how many millions of visits across, incidentally. There are external factors that reflect themselves in these issues. I don't know how to be dominating. I just wanted to put these things on the table for possible discussion or factoring it in your own scientific and academic analysis on things. I can go on. Any questions or anything? Can I give you thank you very much, Lord Rothian? Jacqueline, of course, why are you so deep?
Yeah, thank you. High Commissioner, thank you very much. We will certainly regret the end of your time here, as you've been a very good friend to GSF over the years. But thank you for your contribution. What I intend to do is to take two at a time and then ask the panel whether they'd like to respond. I might say not every member of the panel needs to respond to every intervention. If we can do it one by one, it's much better. I'll take one more at the moment. Robert Walker, in the end.
My question actually very nicely follows on from the question of the comments by the Commission. Because Cypriots amongst this diaspora are almost unique in being able to exercise democratic rights in the UK, being able to vote as a matter of right. But I really wanted to raise two very related points amongst the diaspora who are, tend to be the better off, better educated, and those who have taken British nationality. Amongst my social circle, perhaps I should declare an interest, I might be counted as diaspora because I do actually have dual British and Turkish nationality. But amongst my social circle, I know an awful lot of people, particularly Turks, who have taken British nationality, American nationality, German, Dutch, and so on. But nonetheless still regard themselves as citizens of their home country. And my question is, how does that affect their, in your analysis, those who gave the presentation, how do you think that affects their attitude to politics here, or politics back at home? That's question number one. Question number two, very quickly, if I may, Michael, is amongst those better educated groups, the effect, it was touched on by one of the speakers, the effect on the home economy of that drainage of skills. We benefit from them. I mean, the National Health Service classically benefits from doctors from all over Europe, including the countries under question. But there are skills in other areas, particularly in business, in IT, and so on, and even in banking, which are denied the home country. And I just wonder what analysis has been done on that as well.
Who would like to pick that up? David.
Can I pick up the first one?
Yes, certainly.
Just to say that...
Can you get closer to the...
Yeah. The contribution from Euripides very clearly explains why we labelled this the role in international relations, because these diasporas do play a role in the relations between the home state and the host state. And that, of course, that plays strongly into bilateral relations and therefore into international relations. And a good example, two good examples of that, actually, of what Euripides said and also Fotini about diasporic views on the Cyprus problem, and also the views of the Serbian diaspora here, which actually, as Fotini also mentioned this, they were actually far less hard line on some of these questions than, the simple soul might have expected. So they do come nicely into international relations.
Thank you. Who'd like to deal with this?
I can deal with your first question. How do they relate to politics in this country, which I think is a very interesting question. One important factor is whether diasporas are historically kind of embedded in this country or whether they are more distant waves. And the region of Southeast Europe has that interest because there are both. On the one hand, there are the Cypriots and the Greeks as well, some Yugoslavs too, who have a second generation. By the way, this table there, it doesn't include, the second generation of family. So the numbers are even, bigger. So those who are historically here, they are much more embedded into the political system of this country, so they can also think ideologically in terms of, which party they would support. For the more recent migrants, there are particular issues, I think, that are very, very pivotal in the way that they think. Obviously, all the migrants and diasporas, they have their connections to politics in their countries. But in here, the issue of Brexit, for instance, is a very important one, and how it, it affects you know, their vote. The issue of migration is also very important. So I suppose, and that's a hypothesis that needs to be carried further, there are those issues that are very, very prominent in the way that they perceive domestic politics in this country. At the same time, they're very attached into the divisions that are happening in their homeland, you know, no matter how many years they live here.
We got a microphone.
Just a brief comment on how those people that have British nationality here but also engage with politics in Cyprus, it's very important that the inclusion of diasporas and their views in the peace settlement, it is essential regarding the interconnectedness, the evolution of the human rights law and the diaspora's own potential role in their unification efforts. But as research has shown, there is the perceived and regularly inflated size of the diasporas often cause resistance in extending voting rights to the diasporic Cypriots.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on now. The lady.
There was my
Emmanuel, do you want to say? All right, yes.
Just to answer to the second question, just in relation to the effect of the emigration of large number of professionals from the countries concerned, but more broadly. And obviously, there are some objective dimensions, such as the loss of public funds, which was invested in the education of those people. The demographic decline that this often leads together with immigration of other people with lower education, and the overall decrease in the country's educational levels and potential for fiscal revenues. But what is most crucial, I think, is when you start having shortages in certain sectors of the economy, as well as when you when a large part of your highly skilled people leave the country, which we know how important knowledge is currently for development, and we speak of the, like the knowledge economy. So it can be detrimental and may lead to a cycle of underdevelopment for certain economies. And here just a brief comment. In terms of shortages, for instance, we haven't seen them yet increase despite the large emigration because of the adequate supply, so to say, of university graduates, and also because of high unemployment rates in Greece. But you do see them in Romania and Bulgaria, for instance, in the health sector. That's a fantastic point. And just a brief comment about the other question about the about citizenship. I guess that acquiring the citizenship of the country you live in shows an urge to participate in the political life of that country. But maybe for those who have the European citizenship, that kind of, and because they were allowed to stay here without the need to acquire permanent residency and through that citizenship, they didn't care that much. And now we see this happening and people claiming and trying to get the British citizenship. And also, there is, in relation to political participation, for some people, there is a sense of alienation, which makes them then want to engage more in the politics of the country where they live, when they're denied the right to participate in the politics of the country where they come from. And we have that in many countries in the region, like Albania, like Greece, and so forth. So that could be another reason that could help.
Thank you very much. The lady on the...
Thank you, Jesse, much for
asking
for this might be a question to Manolis, often already mentioned a little bit, but I'm very interested in the different types or different ways of diaspora, the ways of migration, and how they differ in their political behavior. In the 1990s, there was a lot of research done about some of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s migrants, Germany, Sweden, the United States, from Western Balkans, Western Europe, and how they influenced the 1990s politics of the former Yugoslavia.
Thank you. Lord Anderson.
Thank you, Michael. Two questions. At either end of the age spectrum, and accepting what the High Commissioner said, that it's very difficult to generalise, is there any evidence that the older generation wish to return to their own countries in retirement? Anecdotally, I see this among many members, many Greek citizens, for example, having a pension, having had a job in the UK, the lure of home attracts them. The other is for younger people who have been educated in the UK, and this has been mutually beneficial. To what extent they are able to go as a system teaching the English language in their countries of origin? It's a very useful resource for them. They improve the language of their parents, the knowledge of the language of their parents, and for those in the home countries of their parents, that they are able to pass on a knowledge of spoken English. And does the British government, the British Council, see this as a useful resource?
Thank you very much. There's two questions. Who would like to answer them? David, do you want to start?
No, I think the first one was specifically intended for Manoli.
Oh, right. Manoli.
Yes. Well, I think I will pass it to Fotinin, in fact. but before that, I will make a brief comment. And that is because Fotinin has worked on political participation more than I. And she has an understanding of how this plays out in terms of different cohorts in relation to this Serbian case in particular, and we have the speaker who spoke about that. But just one point, just to corroborate what you were saying, in terms of the difference of the between the waves of migration, and it's the type of migration and how it was institutionalized as such, because during the 60s and 70s, it took place in the context of the so-called guest worker programs. It was like part of bilateral agreements between states and concerned certain sectors of the economy. Whereas now you have a much more diverse flow of people, increasingly so, including highly skilled young people, and especially within the context of the European Union. And as you say, there seems to be some correlation in terms of more cosmopolitan and open progressive views of the second cohort, whereas the first one was more traditional and even like tended to be exercising nationalism from abroad. But I don't know if you want to add something.
Yes, maybe to add also the role of the diaspora entrepreneurs and the context that the host land, for example, plays. And the power of diaspora activists derive from the socio-spatial positions in particular contexts. So what I'm trying to say, perhaps also the context where migrants go might play a significant role. For example, on the Bosnian diaspora, political agents, they have benefited from the Dutch political context to make transnational activist claims. The Dutch context became a hub for contentious politics because of unresolved issues related to the questionable implications of the Dutch peacekeeping forces in the 1995 Srebrenica genocide. So the Dutch hub empowered the Dutch political agents to make transnational activist claims, not only regarding the case of Srebrenica, but also concerning other war atrocities. So perhaps we have to look every time the context and the host country as well.
Alton, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I want to add to Fotini and respond briefly to the other comments. Now, Jesse, I agree with Fotini that this has to be highly contextualized. Also because, as everybody said, this is not a monolithic kind of body, diasporas, and they, you know, there are many, many differences. First of all, in the country where they go to, but at the same time, you know, their own kind of identification with various issues. So when we're talking about the former Yugoslavs, Yugoslavs and former Yugoslavs, one has to think as to what kind of migrants they were. They were the dissidents, so they had a certain, you know, purpose for leaving the country and then going abroad. They were the economic migrants, so they kept a different connection with their country. I once had a student that was doing the connections between the Catholics from Croatia and Germany and how they kept in touch with the, you know, with the Catholic Church in Croatia. Then when the wars took place, I don't know how easy it was for all of them, or for most of them actually, to disengage from these kind of events, and how polarized they themselves, you know, must have become in terms of supporting one or the other side. So it's very much part of the, you know, of the chronological, you know, environment and the context, and also the geographical. As for the ones returning, whether they're the older or the younger, and how they could contribute, one thing that is common in all countries of Southeast Europe is that all of the diasporic people, they do like the countries because they are nice and shiny and, you know, touristically, you know, beautiful, and in the summer they're even more beautiful. So they, all of them, they just want to keep their links to the Mediterranean homeland and, you know, eventually may want to go back as well. There are many of them actually building homes, which they, this is one way of remitting and investing in the country, but also for them in the later years. As for the English language, I'm not sure whether the British, I mean, would you know that? Yeah.
Yeah. In my experience, the British Council work very closely with language schools in other countries, as you would expect. I mean, the British Council can't possibly cope with the millions of people who want to learn English, so language schools play an important role in that, and I'm quite sure that many, you know, ex-diasporic people end up teaching in language schools.
And if I may add one thing on the question about return, speak about in relation to some evidence that we have coming from the Greek case. So we are doing a survey, and as a result of this survey, it seems that a very limited number of people are planning to return within the next 3 years. It's less than 15%. Some would wish, but they feel they are not ready yet. Then we have like 25%. But when you look at the longer run, more than 60% plans to return.
Retirement.
To retirement, or even a little bit earlier if they manage to fulfill their goals.
Yes, Euripides.
If I may be allowed to. If I may be allowed to just try to enrich and perhaps enrich the debate or lack thereof, and I'm apologies for speaking for the second time. First of all, I'm suggesting you have a thought about it, somehow publish the work that you have already done and the presentations. It's very, very important. And as far as I know, nothing exists for the UK diaspora. Some exist in the United States. And maybe you can draw from that. So that's number one. I wanted to flag it. On the issue of voting rights, we do not give voting rights to the diaspora. And it is one of their permanent requests. Many of them came after the events of 1974, after the invasion, and they say, we have lost everything. Again, they don't think that's the right to vote. And that's a huge debate. There are pros and cons. Things are not moving as they should, but it is a permanent request of the community, because they do obviously keep their links. They have properties and they have... and when we say, by way of a buzzword, a soundbite, they are the human bridge, it is true. And one can dissect that, and they are the human bridge between, let's say, Cyprus and the United Kingdom. And that cuts across whether it is culture, whether it is trade, whether it is economics, and whether it is politics. On the issue of citizenship, or the citizenship, it's nice to know that we are loved and we're being rediscovered again because of Brexit, because it's the applications to get citizenship in order to get an EU passport have increased in the last 3 years more than 1,100%. And we cannot cope. It takes forever to get the citizenship. Forever Brandis's question about repatriation and the old generation to return. They do keep, as I said, the links, but it's one thing to keep the links, and it's another thing to repatriate yourself and to go home. And there, they meet a lot of difficulties, including disappointment of the institutions for Cyprus, including disappointment. Whether this is buying property, but they have yet to receive the title deed. Unheard of, unorthodox, criminal, but they have not yet because of whatever bureaucracy or the bill they went under. The infamous bail-in, the financial crisis in which actually they went into your bank account and they took everything except 100,000. And for me, it's highway robbery. Okay? And they were a number of them were affected. Therefore, they say, listen, we are ambassadors in the sense of goodwill ambassadors, giving voluntarily from our time and from our money, while you, me, is getting paid to do a job. We're doing these things, and you guys, your institutions disappoint us. And in some ways, I won't say betray us, but put it disappoint us. And my heart goes out. Because it is unfair. Now, as David Madden has said, there's a lot of work that's been done by the British Council in teaching English, including some of the diaspora that do go back to teach. I hosted an event in the High Commission not too long ago exactly on these issues and how educating the mind is the biggest investment that we can all make.
Thank you very much. I've got room for two more questions now. The gentleman opposite me, and then the Slovenian ambassador.
Thank you. Actually, if you allow me, I have a question, but I wanted just to put something on the table that was missing, I think, from this discussion. Thanking, first of all, Lodlothian for this very important and necessary gathering, and for the work of scientists that have produced. I noted that Kosovo was missing from the charts, apart from the 26,000, which I still think is very low, below the, and I'll come back to the data as well. What I wanted to say is a couple of things about Kosovo diaspora. And it started in the 60s in Europe. Only people who had no jobs in Kosovo would leave. Then during the autonomy time, no one wanted to leave. Mind you, we had no visas for UK. Nobody came. And all started in 1989 with the abolition of autonomy. I was personally asked in 86 to come and visit London. I said no, because I had just graduated and wanted to get a job and continue with my life over there. Not that I didn't want to see London. But in 1989, it started, and it started with university graduates leaving. I used to work in district court in Pristina, and one day I was told by the president, who happened to be served, that as of Monday, 70% of Albanians should not come to work. When we come, the police will wait for us at the doorstep. I had family here, came on visa, regularly, legally, and studied. So I was not a diaspora, I became a diaspora. And 20 years ago, on today's day, with major intervention in Kosovo entering, and with Challenger tanks that I've seen on BBC entering Pristina, I decided to leave London, got a ticket, and went. Only with nothing in my pockets. Empty pockets with some knowledge that I gathered here, and worked on the re-establishing the judiciary from 1999 until now. Since 2 years I now am as a diplomat, Kosovo diplomat, first generation, even happy to be in UK after 18 years. So, by this, I want to say that I know a bit of mentality that was touched upon of a diaspora person, of us. Some of them leave because of the war. Some of them leave because they have been expelled, and the attachment of those people with their country is not the same. It varies. In Kosovo's case, about 1 million people that were expelled, more than 90% of them went back.
90.
And this was reported in the media, and I know for sure that in the year people were not allowed to go back. But I am. I was calling them every day for my family, four of them, my parents and two brothers, to go back. They were not allowed. At the end, I decided to go on my own, and 2 weeks back, I found my father and my brother at the doorstep. They couldn't stay more than 2 weeks. So, the other reason that is important is the brain drain. Responding to you about the schools in English, a friend of mine who used to live in the UK runs a school of English in Christiania. And some other people have opened as well. The British are something doing good as well. I'll touch up on two sort of questions.
Can you keep it reasonably brief?
Voting is very important, and the data should be more quality. Not, by birth is not enough to qualify the diaspora. Excuse me, because there are more people than on the chart, I believe. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And finally, the Slovenian ambassador.
Thank you so much, Lodoni and Lutz for organizing this event, especially also CISANS, also University. I think it's important that the region gets also the attention and constant attention also in the future. My question would be very short. So we see that CISANS have done a lot of research and analysis and studies of diaspora, its role. But my question would be maybe more in the future. So is there any prediction how this will affect, I mean, the recent development on Brexit? What will affect the diaspora? Probably there will be also a different operation system which will pick specific parts of future diaspora. I think I just thought to attract more street workers, not maybe freedom of movement basis, but more on the knowledge basis. So is there any vision how this, of course, it's not Brexit is not done here yet, but still probably this will be somehow affected also for the future of the diaspora. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm now going to give each of the panelists 1 minute to make a quick response and anything else they want to add. I'm going to start in the same order as we went before. Manolis first.
Okay. Just a brief comment. Just a brief comment as a sort of tentative answer to the question of the Slovenian ambassador, coming from some data that we have at hand present. So for most nationals, emigration has tended to reduce in absolute numbers during this but it is enough not for Bulgarians and Greeks. Now, in terms of the profile of the migrants who will keep on coming to this country after the Brexit happens, should it happen, I guess that at present we can only speculate because we do not know exactly what will be the policy that will be put in place, and apparently currently there is some prioritization towards migration of high-skilled people, but of course that neglects the fact that there are needs in other sectors of the economy, and the service economy is huge in this country, and so I'm not sure whether this will work as such. So it's still we need to see how this thing will play out, to know a little bit how it will evolve.
Yes, would you like to go next? Nothing to say.
Yes, I've got a general point to make because the issue of vote has been raised, and it's a particularly important point because diasporic vote in most cases is insignificant in terms of affecting national elections in the country. But in some cases, it can be marginally affecting the outcome of elections. One example is the election of President Ioannis in Romania. The diaspora vote was particularly important in terms of turning the tide towards this German president of Romania. And similarly, what I mentioned before, the emphasis that President Erdogan in particular gave towards diasporic vote. So what we've been discussing here is diaspora in two ways. One is as an identity. So how do they feel in the country where they live? What kind of roles do they play? And then the identity that is connected to homeland, you know, how much they're connected in various economic, political, and other ways with the homeland. And the other issue that is related to vote is the issue of citizenship. And that is a very important role for diaspora because it actually links the diaspora person to the state of homeland, but also to the state of the host country. And that's why the issue of vote is particularly important. Now, in countries like Greece or Cyprus, with historical, big historical diasporas in the West, the issue of vote is a very sensitive one because it's the decision of the homeland whether to allow people to vote abroad or not. That's a very tricky question because politicians always have to think of the outcome of the electoral outcome and how that is going to affect their relationship to power. And that's why it's very difficult for them. Who to include in this voting partner? It's a very unjust thing. Who is considered to be a citizen of the homeland or not is a very, very difficult issue, very tricky issue that politicians have to decide who have in their mind, not a philosophical question, but actually is the diaspora going to vote for them or not. And my final thing on Brexit is that at the moment what we see is that there is uncertainty. Maybe numbers are put off to come to the UK, but I think everybody at the moment is in the waiting as to what's going to happen, how they are going to be affected. Those who have managed to do the citizenship or the settled status are going to remain. The others will have to decide on the spot and see how they're going to approach the situation that arises after Brexit.
David, 30 seconds.
This point has been made before, but I think it's worth repeating. The traditional played a very big role on issues like enlargement, relations with Southeast Europe. Okay, we may be fixated elsewhere at the moment, but these other issues have not gone away, and we in CSOC firmly believe that they need looking at. And we're delighted, Lord Lothian, with you. You obviously share this view, so thank you very much for working together, and Jacqueline as well. I mean, it's important to keep looking at these issues as well.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for keeping to time, everybody. Makes my job so much easier. For my part, I think we've had a most interesting morning. We've raised almost as many questions as we've answered, which suggests that we may come back to looking at this again sometime in the future, and I look forward to that. But I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all our panellists, who I think have done a very good job this morning, and particularly David Madden for everything he's done personally to make this event possible. I'd ask you to thank them in the traditional way. Thank you.